for years, it was the case that when I would drive from Portland to Boise, like, there's that part where you're on I-84 when you're in the gorge, and then you turn away from the river and kind of enter the desert. And I always, for a long time, I really dreaded that part. And then I very clearly remember the drive, when I was driving back to Boise with my U-Haul full of stuff, and like not even really glancing at the gorge as I was moving through that section of it, and then just feeling like, when I made that shift outside of Pendleton, going away from the river, just being like, yes, this is it. This is my landscape.
Welcome to Sema, a podcast on loss, grief, and healing. My name is C.L. Young, and in this episode, I talk with poet Tyler Brewington. We spoke inside the moment between the insurrection at the Capitol and the presidential inauguration, both of us in Boise, Idaho, where we each currently live. Though the overt presence of white nationalism has been a reality in Idaho since I can remember, this has escalated profoundly over the past several months. I don't have answers about how to best be useful here, and in this conversation, Tyler and I continue our long exploration of the many questions we have about Boise, as well as ideas of friendship loss, the self, time, and writing after grief. Tyler Brewington is the author of the chapbook Dear Stray Volcano from Alice Blue, and with Kelly Sherman, the collections Nature Machine and Boyfriend Mountain from Poor Claudia. As always, please be careful with yourself when choosing to take in any media, including this podcast. And thank you so much for being here.
I went to the art museum yesterday.
You did?
I did. I was in there for about an hour and a half. It was the longest span of time I've spent indoors at a public place since the pandemic started. And it was great. I had the whole place entirely to myself. Like there was a person at the front desk, and then one docent. Sweet teen docent in there. But otherwise, it was just me. And the exhibit that they have right now is photography, lots of photographs, and then other artworks that kind of consider notions of the Great Basin, what it means to have. Like the Great Basin is defined by the fact that its waterways drain internally. So lots of gorgeous photographs from like the Nevada test site, lots of photographs from the Great Salt Lake and the surrounding shoreline, and a couple of earthworks like, Spiral Jetty, and then another one that was new to me called Sun Tunnels. It was really great to see. And I was so grateful to be alone in that space because I cried a lot. And as I was in there and having this really, really powerful emotional response to the things I was seeing, I was wondering like exactly where it was coming from. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that my dad was a pilot. And when I think about who I am and where I'm from, when I have ideas about what it means to live in Idaho or to be from Idaho, there's a part of my thinking that feels very much informed by a perspective of seeing things from above. And I think that has to do with like my earliest, very, very earliest childhood understandings of what it means to be a pilot, what it means to fly a reconnaissance jet. I remember being in elementary school and, people's parents would come in for like career day, and my dad and there were a couple other kids in my elementary school whose parents also worked for the Idaho Air National Guard. And a couple of days before they came in, they would fly over our school and take a picture and then show us that picture when they were there. So it was maybe one of the earliest times, you know, when I was in elementary school in the early 80s, like our culture was in some ways much, much less visual than it is now. Mm-hmm. So maybe it was one of my earliest experiences of even seeing a photograph like that, you know, of seeing my world presented from above. So it really, I was not, when I went to the museum, I wouldn't say that my thinking about my dad, like, and that grief, it wasn't very much on my mind, but then it felt so present while I was in that space.
I think there's something about this landscape and growing up here that allows for that even when you're not in the air. And mm-hmm. this, mm-hmm. Like the fact that, you know, we can climb up in the foothills in 5 minutes and be able to see the entire city and the, you know, 360 degrees around to see behind
yes
the city. And I just walked up Camel's Back before our conversation, and that's become such an essential part of my well-being, is to be able to get perspective from above.
Mm-hmm.
And always one of my wonders of the world is flying into Boise.
Has that been consistent for you, or have you noticed that changing?
I think it has always been true for me. Okay. Like ever since I moved away, at least, I guess.
Yeah. I remember going to Portland a couple of years before I moved there myself, and flying back into Boise and crying on the plane because I thought, this is so ugly. Like, I hate this. It was in the summer, so of course the desert and the mountains were wearing their brown outfits. And I remember finding it so repulsive, so oppressive, so depressing. And then towards the end of my time in Portland, I again had the experience of coming back to Boise for a visit and noticing that as I was landing, that nothing had ever been more beautiful to me and nothing ever would be as beautiful to me as that experience, is getting to watch the mountains give way to the valley, and just seeing how Boise materializes from the air.
You moved back to Boise not unrelated to your father's illness, right?
Yes. When I did decide to move back here, the idea had been swirling. Like, I definitely consciously acknowledged to myself that it was an option on the table and something that I was considering. I knew that I no longer felt very happy in Portland, and I wanted a change. I hadn't yet decided that that coming back here would be the change that I would for sure make. But I definitely had moving on the mind.
Yeah.
But then, yes, it did become clear that my dad's health was declining. I could tell just by, you know, coming here for visits and talking to him on the phone. I could tell that things were shifting, and it did feel important to be back here. The period of time in which we were moving through illness and the decline, the catastrophic series of strokes that led to his time in the hospital and ultimately the end of his life. There are ways in which I don't feel like, you know, maybe my conception of like what time is and how time works in general has shifted, but I don't feel like I'm less comfortable making a distinction now. And it feels to me like that time is always present. Like, I'm always alive in that time in some ways. It's difficult to talk about. I feel English failing me when I try to talk about this. And maybe I simply wouldn't have attempted to articulate it before, because in some ways it's really scary. Like, it's comforting to think that there was this hard time that I lived through that then ended. And that doesn't feel very true to me to conceptualize it that way now. certain feelings. Like, obviously, my day-to-day life is different. Like, I'm not going to visit him in the hospital every day. I'm not wondering what day he's actually going to die. You know, that stuff is in the past, the quote-unquote past. Those events have occurred. But my emotional experience, the way that those experiences have informed the way that I think and the way that I live, I can't square that with my previous notions of time. I'm sorry, I'm probably not doing a very good job of explaining this, and it does feel like it's really, really hard to explain. But I also, it feels like there's an urgency around trying to talk to you about this, because I feel like if I'd had a conversation about this with somebody who'd maybe lived through something similar, I like to think that maybe it would have been helpful. I mean, who knows? Who knows whether I would have been able to receive any of that information or not. You know, there was so much stuff that I did take, so many different kinds of information that I did try to take in, and so many conversations that I did try to have that I thought would be helpful or thought would be a comfort at that time that weren't, that just missed me for whatever reason. I remember talking to a therapist a few months ago, maybe about a year ago, who told me that the experience of extreme grief is so, like, literally deranging. Like, you'll never be as out of your mind while you're experiencing deep grief. There's nothing that compares to that neurologically, unless it is the experience of, you know, some kind of chemical shift in your brain that brings on a different mental state that you can, you know, that would need to be treated with medication, or, you know, or like a traumatic brain injury. You know, like, deep grief has the same cognitive effects, which I didn't know, you know, and I just didn't know that for a long time. Yeah. Yeah. And who knows, you know, again, if somebody had suggested that to me in those weeks when my dad was in a hospital or in memory care facilities, I don't know if that would have felt true, or it could have been just, you know, in one ear and out the other.
Yeah. There's something about what you're saying about time, or what you said about time, that I've been thinking about so much for the last few years or so, like the feeling that time is not what I thought it was at all. Mm-hmm. Which I guess that conception must have been a certain linearity or something.
Yeah.
Or like horizontal quality, uh-huh. I guess.
Yes.
And I think that the farther I get into my life and the more people that I've lost, the more I think of time as such a vertical thing,
mm-hmm.
and like a layered thing, mm-hmm. and sort of always like these different iterations of my life, or different iterations of relationships. I mean, back to the idea of friendship loss and all of that, like, it has become a comfort to me to think of all of those things always occurring.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe this is part of why being at the museum yesterday and seeing those photographs felt so powerful to me. There was something, one placard on the wall, I can't remember which photographer was saying this now, but there was some line, some kind of like artist statement that said something about how when you see these images of the desert and so what a lot of the photographs were trying to capture was, you know, the effect of human life, human interventions on the desert. So the ways in which the landscape has been altered by human activity. But there was some line in there about how when you see the desert, when you see these landscapes, you really do get the feeling that time is something you can hold in your hand. And that feels very true to me. And like what you were saying about, you know, being able to climb up camel's back and to be able to have that viewpoint, you know, on a clear day, we can see also clear across the valley, the Snake River Plain, to the Owyhees. So
yeah.
There's also, it's really part, I think, of living in Boise and being an Idahoan is that I think a sense of geological time is kind of always sort of running in the background just because it is so visible, and that sense of time can be quite present. Like even at Camelsback, there's this, you know, some sections of the hill that have fallen away, and you can see the layered quality of the sandstone, you know, where the birds make their nests. So yeah, I think that all of these things inform my ideas around grief and my ideas of loss, I think, in ways that maybe will only reveal themselves more fully as I keep living or as I keep trying to talk about them. It does feel kind of important to me to state again, this idea of learning my grief rhythm. Mm-hmm. My dad died on January 8th of 2018. So we've just passed the 3-year anniversary. And he did have a series of strokes in mid-August of 2019, which precipitated, you know, the final decline. His neighbors found him in his driveway and called the ambulance, and then he never did go back home again. He was, for the most of the time, most of the remainder of his life, he was in the hospital with a couple of brief disastrous stints in a couple of different memory care facilities. And I guess, you know, especially in the first year after his death, what I expected or what I would have felt like made sense was for there to be on January 8th, this feeling of immense grief, like marking that date would have been the day, like the big day, the big grief day. And what's become clear to me over the course of this past year is that what happens for me is that I kind of start this downward emotional spiral in August, around the time that he would have gone into the hospital. It kind of peaks for me in between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Thanksgiving 2019 was the last time I felt like he recognized me.
Wait, 2017.
Oh, I'm right. Sorry. Yes, 2017. Okay. That was the last time, the last visit I had to him where I felt like he saw me, mm-hmm. and knew who I was. And for each successive visit after that, like he wasn't, like I never got the sense that my presence bothered him in any way. But that Thanksgiving was definitely the last time where I felt like he definitely saw and recognized me. And from then on out, he was kind of drifting in and out of consciousness. He was often asleep or just not very, very lucid when he was awake. I think I would have thought that like the grief day would be like a birthday, you know, like you have this one day where it all feels very present and then it just kind of leaves again the next day. And that's not how it works for me anyway. The day, January 8th now seems to me like the day where I finally start climbing back out of that a little bit. It's not like a culmination. It's not like I experienced this frenzy of grief that just builds and builds until the 8th and then breaks. It just kind of, you know, it's hard not to liken it to the Persephone myth, you know, like the spending some time in the underworld and then being allowed to come back up.
I'd love to talk a little bit more about friendship loss, because I think that like losses of friendships of people still living
mm-hmm.
have been some of the most painful experiences of my life and kind of continue to be. Like, they haunt me in different ways.
Yes.
Than like losses through death, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And I find, and I think it has, I don't know if you feel this way, but I think it has a lot to do with the same kinds of impulses that make me a writer. Because I think I often think of those friendship losses as being the result of some kind of miscommunication or like my failure to communicate myself effectively, such that how could this person who I loved so dearly or felt such intimacy with ever construe our relationship or me or something that happened within our relationship such that they wanted it to be over.
Yes.
And it always has felt like such a failure. And I don't mean like it's always my fault or something exactly, but I think just the losses of those relationships, even now, it just stings in a different way.
Absolutely. I can think of a couple friendships that have ended that still sting me to think about. It does feel like a great failure has occurred. And again, not to place blame entirely on myself, but it definitely does feel like, or it can be easy to let myself feel like, you know, I've been truly seen and found wanting, or or at some, you know, some critical juncture, I failed to communicate or to present the version of myself that might have saved whatever there was to save. And it's so painful because there's the sense that something could have been done. You know, when somebody leaves your life because they've died, you know, there's a finality. It's not like, you know, it's not like I could have saved my dad's life. Or in the case of friends who have died, it's not, you know, there's literally nothing I could have done.
Yeah.
And they're gone. But when somebody is still alive out there, having chosen not to have anything further to do with me, it is painful to think about that.
There is something particularly just stinging about knowing people are walking around in the world and not being able to understand what their conception of that loss is either.
Right, right. Yeah, and the pain, you know, my friend Emily and I often have this joke about how when relationships shift or end, especially when there's a sense that maybe you feel wronged, like in the case of a breakup, like if you feel like somebody hasn't treated you fairly, and you have that urge for justice or some version of justice to be done, like really the only way to have any kind of justice or any kind of revenge would be for the person to be able to see things exactly the same way as you do.
Yeah.
And that's never going to happen. So we're always like the punchline of the joke is always like, why can't everyone just be me? You know, like it would be so much easier if everyone were just me. And then, you know, that way your edges would never have to scrape against any of the edges that are out there in the world. But of course that's totally impossible. This is reminding me that, you know, I mentioned just a few minutes ago that when I moved to Portland, my good friend Heather was already there. But also within just a few months of arriving in Portland, I entered into a long-term monogamous relationship. And that person's friend group became my friend group. And that was kind of the extent, except for Heather and her sister and a couple of their friends, like his friends, my partner's friends were pretty much like, that was it. That was my whole world. And then when our relationship ended pretty suddenly, all of that went away instantly. And that's something that absence, I think, haunts me more, a lot more than anything having to do with the relationship I had with my partner. It's the that constellation of friends and people who I loved and cared for and thought of as good friends, like just vanished. And I don't blame them. I mean, I think I would expect the same of my close friends in a similar situation. You know, that makes sense to me. I don't want to blame anyone for going away in the way that they did, but it's also like it's so much more painful. Like the romantic relationship at this point is just like whatever, water under the bridge. But the loss of those
Right.
friendships like will probably hurt forever.
Totally, because it's it has not that has almost nothing to do with you too, and
Right.
I think
Yeah, and it can be a great comfort to think about the fact that it often has very little to do with you personally. It's generally not a you-based problem. It's something that's going on with the other person. Like it's comforting to think about that, but also terrifying because for me at least, it kind of calls attention to the fact that we're all so alone, like so alone in our own constructions of how we are experiencing our life and what we think of as reality.
exactly. Well, and I think like there, I've been trying to get myself to a place like on a good day where I can think of those lost friendships or lost romantic relationships and really be centered in the idea of, oh, that was a person who was in my life for that period of time for a reason. And I learned something, and we learned something from each other. We were finding something from each other. And then something happened to one or both of us. And it became, we needed someone else, or we needed to be seen in a different way. I need distance from certain relationships because I need to be understood as the person I am presently. And that's so funny in Boise, particularly because they're just like, you and I have both lived here multiple times, and we've both lived in other places. And there can be this just really beautiful layering of different lives, but also really complicated and frustrating because I have to make this like concerted effort living here not to regress into past versions of myself.
Yes, I could not agree more. There's, oh gosh, one thing that's coming up for me right now is that in Emily Gold's first book of essays, And the Heart Says Whatever, there's a part in there. I'm not going to be able to remember the title of the specific essay, but there's a line in there where she talks about growing up, basically, the passage of time. And she says something like, the hardest thing about getting older in the same place where you were young is that your mistakes become so clear to you. Like all of the paths that you could have taken, the different directions you could have gone. When you stay in the same place or return to the same place, it just feels so visible. So yeah, thinking a lot about that. I've been really lucky in that I've had a really core group of dear friends since my late teens, very early 20s. And I feel like one of the reasons we've stayed close is that for whatever reason, we continue to be able to see each other as we grow and as we
Yes,
change. So that having that kind of anchor, like it's impossible to overstate the importance of having that kind of anchor. It's made me feel like I could be brave enough to try living in a different city for a little while, and like I could be brave enough to come back here. Being able to see the way that I've changed, or to be able to talk to trusted friends and hear them make observations about how I've changed in ways that I trust, or in ways that I consider, worth thinking about and worth taking in. That has been so important. And that I think that really helps too with the what you were talking about in terms of the regression, because it can, especially, I don't really have anything to compare, any other city to compare Boise with, but yeah, also because I mean, Boise feels like just the right size for regression in some ways. Like it's so easy to slip back into past selves and old patterns and old habits. Like you can just keep on going to the same places and keep having the same kinds of relationships over and over again if you want to. For several months, like when the pandemic first started, like I feel like one of the reasons why this sense of isolation felt so traumatic and so scary was because when you, like that system of relationality, that's just the habit of, you know, seeing acquaintances just over the course of living a life, like going to see live music, going to see art, going for hikes more often than I do now. I would see constantly people who I'm very fond of, who I think of as friends, maybe not the people I, you know, would turn to in times of deep crisis, but definitely people I respect and care for and enjoy seeing and being around. But so much of that went away when the pandemic started. So then, like, you were all, like, for me especially, I felt like I really have to sit with myself, my own self, and spend a lot of time with myself in ways that are not constructions of self that I see reflected back to me by a larger network of people. Like, it's just me and my cat in my mirror, you know? Like, there's no there's no opportunity for me to, you know, try on maybe different identity, not slip into whole other identities, but, you know, when you're interacting with different people with whom you have different relationships, like, I think it's fair to say that that different aspects of my personality are maybe sometimes heightened, or, you know, different characteristics come to the fore, fade to the background, or whatever. So it's not as if I become a totally different person, but there are subtle shifts in how I communicate and how I am with people that do kind of, you know, as a whole, operate as sort of a construction of myself, how I experience myself. So much of that feedback is gone. So now it's just up to me to, like, sit in my apartment and look around at my things and be like, wow, this is really who I am.
Especially living in Boise, I think, because there is that thing of seeing people yes. all the fucking time, yeah. whether you like it or not. Like, I watch my third grade teacher run by my window every morning. But that's how Boise is. Like, I go to the grocery store and I could see my ex-boyfriend's mom, my preschool teacher, my, you know, person I don't, whatever. Like, you see all these people all yes. the time. And that's something I was really battling with in my first year, I think, back here. There was this feeling of, I can't relax into
yes.
myself, or even uh-huh. locate yes. myself yeah. fully. One side of that is also, like, seeing who you are as reflected mm-hmm. by those people. I think that you're right, that there's something about this thing that we're in that is so, I am changing and changed. I have changed yeah. so much.
I don't have a very solid background in philosophy or any kind of sciences of the mind. Like, I don't know where we're at culturally in terms of our understanding of, like, what is the self and whether or not there is a stable self. And I also don't know, like, I think at one point in time, it definitely would have been my impulse to undertake, like, a research project about that. I would have been like, I'm going to find out which philosophers have theories of the self, and I'm going to find out what brain scientists are studying in terms of what parts of the brain are activated when we think about the self. Really read up on all of that, and then arrive at a place of knowing, or maybe being able to piece together some framework that makes sense to me. And I don't think it's that I'll ever not be interested in that question, but it doesn't feel super relevant. Like, I think that the kind of understanding that I'm interested in has more to do with what you were just talking about, just being able to notice and to embody the changes as they occur. And that feels like to me, maybe a, like it's a little bit easier to be in the world that way because I don't have to feel like I'm constantly like fighting to level up to some new way of understanding or that the process of growing up has to entail like this point of arrival at some like more enlightened space or some place of like improvement or like getting, you know, the process of getting from this place now, which is a place with limitations and drawbacks and flaws, but I have to get over to this place where things will be more perfect or more whole. Like, I don't think that my understanding of knowledge has evolved in a way I think that doesn't really allow for that kind of conception. Like, maybe I don't need to be able to ask myself, what is the self? What is myself? And to be able to answer in a way that feels very declarative and straightforward. Maybe what is the self can be the process of, like, if I were to leave my house right now and walk towards the foothills, I would encounter like what 3 to 7 different people I've known for many years or at least seen around. And maybe that's all the self is just noticing how those things change over time.
I think to me, it's also becoming like, I don't need to be legible.
Yeah, even yes, to myself. Yes.
And I think it's like I've been feeling this movement away from language for a while now in that way, particularly this feeling. And not, of course, I still utilize language and want to write and all of those things. But I think in moments of real crisis and uncertainty, what I feel like I need is not to write it down or make it legible, but to yes. let it move through my yes. body.
Yes, I love that you brought up the notion of legibility. This is something I've been thinking about quite a bit recently. Question of how to be alive in Boise right now during this particular time, given our sense of, you know, various different political and social urgencies. I think I started thinking about this in terms of my own personal safety because, you know, like last Wednesday, there was a small demonstration here in front of our state house, which is, you know, if I turn my head to the left and look out my front windows, I can see our state house from my front windows. I'm guessing that there will be another kind of demonstration on Inauguration Day. So I'm thinking about like what it means. Like I've never really been the kind of person who takes a lot of chances in terms of self-presentation. Like, I don't feel like I have a very like flamboyant way of dressing or of being in the world. And it's, I think maybe part of that does have to do with growing up in suburban Boise, Idaho in the 80s and 90s and feeling like I very much had to like assimilate or blend in or, you know, essentially just not be gay in order to survive. And now living in Boise, in the neighborhood that I do, there's a part of me that really does want to be legible in that way, just so that other people who live here can see me and maybe feel less alone. And maybe it's presumptuous to think that I can offer anything to anyone that would help them feel less alone. But it does feel important to me to not hide any aspect of myself in that way. And I, of course, I want to be safe. I don't want to feel like a target. And that's a difficult feeling for me to navigate too. But I also like how, when I move my body around the city, how is it legible? What do other people see?
There is this push and pull between, and obviously my experience is different from your experience, and there's a push and pull between, and in all aspects, not even just in legibility, but in like the extent to which I voice how I really mm-hmm. feel growing up here and just kind of like seeing what the water was, I guess, and existing in this sort of like middle space of like, I know what the radical progressive left idea is, and I know what the sort of moderate middle of the road Boise Democrat mm-hmm. idea is. And like trying to negotiate those things and understand how to push the idea, the foreword, without scaring the moderate idea so much that I alienate it and make it so that I'm no longer being listened to at all.
Yes, that's, yes. I, on Christmas Day, my brother and I met at our mom's house and chatted in her driveway at a safe distance for about an hour. And of course, the conversation inevitably turned to US politics at one point. And for a while, like, they're both good, like moderate Democrats, you know, they're in a lot of ways, their hearts are in the right place, as we say. But also, as the conversation progressed, I could see them, you know, past a certain point, I could see them. I saw myself losing them. Like, I saw, like, I felt them slipping away as I began to speak in ways that felt more true to what I believe. Yes, and that is such a hard, it's such a painful thing to notice when it's my own family members. But in any, with friends, with acquaintances, with anyone, it's, there definitely, there does come a point where I feel like, I'm losing you. And I don't know what the answer to that question is either, because it does feel like such a, like a kind of surrender or a compromise I don't want to make when I edit what I say, or when I choose not to present certain ideas that I hold dear, to be in this situation where it feels like in order to make quote unquote progress, I have to be quiet. That's hard. That's really hard for me.
Like, to bring it back to what you were saying in terms of legibility of the self-expression, like, externally, mm-hmm. I think that you're right, that there is something about expressing that and making it legible that can be empowering, or maybe not empowering isn't the right word, but can be, can create a condition for other people to do the same thing, or to feel safe doing the same thing. But it's a hard balance, because, and I think that I feel so fucking grateful to have grown up here too, because I do feel like I have some conception of who these flipping people are, you know?
Yes.
And how complicated it is to try to actually, you know, for hearts and minds, like, I do have some fucking conception of how complicated that is and how delicate. And I think that there's a place for that pushing, you know, that we're talking about. And that it's also like, where do, you know, if we really want to bring these poles together, if that's really on the table, and I don't know if it really is, and we were talking about that the other day too, but if that is really a desire to bring people together to some kind of common understanding, there is some level of, like, middle.
There is, yeah. I think so too. Like, I definitely, you know, that framework is familiar to me. I know that my thinking operates often along those same lines. And sometimes I wonder if that kind of framework where we conceptualize, like, being on the left or think of our own positions or our beliefs as being in some way extreme, it seems to me like something about even that vocabulary or that framework doesn't sit all the way right with me. But at the same time, I can't imagine beyond it either. Like, I can't suggest to you, like, it's easy for me to say in this moment, that doesn't feel all the way right to me, but it would be impossible for me to offer to you another framework or another way of trying to think about this. Something else that I think has just become very clear to me, I mean, an understanding that I've had on some level for much of my adult life, but that has been brought into very sharp relief over the course of the past year, is the extent of my conditioning, my programming, the extent to which the United States population is so incredibly subject to propaganda from birth. Like, I am so much a product of the public education system. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, I grew up in the suburbs of Boise, Idaho in the 80s and 90s. So of course, so much of my thinking is going to be shaped by what passed for common understanding at that point. Like when I think about the ways, especially in which I've been taught history, like it's criminal. Like my sense of US history and world history, it's literally a crime that I've been presented that picture of history. It's so terrible. How do you work? How do I really take in that kind of understanding and then duplicate and reproduce and make that visible to other people? Like, that's the question that I have such a hard time answering. Like, I don't know why. I mean, I think that the fact that I am gay has a lot to do with this, but it's endlessly fascinating to me. The fact that I grew up so steeped in this environment and became the person who I am today and not the person who's walking around in front of the state house wrapped in a don't tread on me flag. You know, how does that happen? And can, like, really, do I have any agency, any power? Can I make those shifts happen for other people? Are you seeing anyone? People eat cream of wheat. Sharks eat people. It's dehumanizing to hope for some relief there. The photos in the basement, lost to a flood. I'll call what I'd like to have, a casual seance. The men in the photos, asleep and moving. Snakes under the table, zit on my eyelid. Men in open jeeps. The dogs of my enemies drool, their thoughts, snowmobiles at the bottom of the lake. But how's your baby? How is your cat adjusting? I think one thing that's happening for me now is that there is enough time has gone by that it starts to feel like grief has started to feel like it has a materiality in the same way that language does. It's something that I can use to build from, to make work out of, you know. And it's not that I feel like I want or need the poems to be suffused with this kind of grief that is specific to me and my dad or the situation of my dad's death. It's more that I can create work that is informed by those experiences without having to be like, oh, I need to tell people exactly what it felt like to me to watch my dad die and to live now with the fact that my dad died. It doesn't have to be this. I mean, I feel like I'm struggling to describe exactly what I'm talking about. And I think in part that's because it does feel mysterious to me in some ways. But maybe it's just that there's a new sense of possibility here that has to do with grief as a kind of clay that can be molded.
Yeah, I've been thinking about something kind of along those lines, though maybe like an offshoot. And I have put away a lot of all mm-hmm. of my writing for a while and mm-hmm. started again and started something new. And I think that's what I've been thinking about with this new writing is where am I not casting away my grief, but what else am I?
Yeah.
And what am I now? Yeah. What can I articulate with that experience inside of me, or standing on that experience, what do I have to say now that is not a rehashing of that experience, but is the whatever voice comes out of having been through that experience?
Yes, precisely. That makes so much sense to me. Also, yeah, the idea of not rehashing, it feels so good to hear you articulate it that way. That's exactly what I think I'm wrestling with and what I need to be able to see beyond right now. Also, there are ways in which I feel like I've hesitated to make this body of work, this manuscript, funny. And one of the ways in which, like, one of the things for which I'll always feel so grateful to my dad is that, like, my sense of humor comes from him. It's funny, like, you don't get to be a general because you move through the world with this sort of irreverence. Like, the man loved a rule for sure. And in some ways I do too, like, but that's a comforting way to think about poetry. Like, poetry has to take a form, like, I have to operate within certain limits. But also, like, if I don't allow the work to have, like, this wry way of looking at the world, this way of, like, I mean, definitely my dad loved a rule, but he loved to break a rule within certain limits too. And that was a big part of his sense of humor. So if I don't allow the work to do those things, or to be funny when I think it maybe wants to be funny, like, that doesn't feel like a way of honoring my dad. So if I want the work to do that, then I do have to let him.
Thank you for listening to Sema. Initiated in 2018 as a reading and workshop series in Boise, Idaho, Sema aspires to nurture deep attention and connection as means for change. To join the mailing list or share your insights, please email sema.readingseries@gmail.com. The song in the background is by Teal Gardner. You can find a link to more of her music in the notes.